The following podcast is part of a special oral history program titled The RSL, A Time to Celebrate. The program documents fascinating and personal stories and experiences of veterans across South Australia. The program received funding through the Veteran and Community Grants stream in partnership with the Tanunda RSL sub-branch and the Emu Tree, and was produced by Christian Teusner. I encourage listeners to take their time to explore as many of these stories and adventures as possible. For further information, visit www.theemutree.com. The date is the 18th of May, 2020. I'm in Burra, sitting here with Ted McMillan. Thank you for participating, Ted. Can you please just state your full name, date of birth, and service number, please?
Well, my full name is Edward George John McMillan. And my date of birth is the 3rd of the 11th, 1925, NX 178482.
Ted, can you please just tell me a little bit about where you were from and maybe some recollections of your childhood?
Right. Well, I'm from Scotland. We came out here in 1927. That was just before the Depression started. My father got a job with the New South Wales Government Railways in the catering department. So he was transferred all over the state, and I went to about 9 different schools, all told, and all in New South Wales.
Do any particular schools stand out above the others, which may be
Wellington, I think, in memories? New South Wales is the best school I went to.
Whereabouts in Scotland were you from?
A place called Islay. It's a small island about 3 miles long and 5 miles wide, and it's claimed to fame and has 9 whiskey distilleries on it. My father was a assistant manager at one of the whiskey distilleries, that's Johnny Walker. And he came out here originally with the idea of starting a distillery in Melbourne, and it didn't eventuate because he couldn't get the money. I mean, the depression was just starting, sort of thing. I think somebody did eventually make whiskey there, and it was probably the second worst whiskey in the world. The worst one's the Japanese one.
Have you been back?
Yeah, I've been back to Scotland, but we couldn't get out to Islay. There's a heavy sea running, and also we had to catch a plane, and the risk was we could get out there, we might not be able to get back, you know.
Primary school days, what sort of things would you do to entertain yourself?
Oh, we used to play cricket after school. We had there was a pitch there, a cement pitch, but we never had any gear, you know. We used to use a kerosene tin, I think, and we had a bat, but that was about it. And then we set up a hockey team on bikes, riding bikes and playing hockey.
How did that work?
Didn't work very well.
How many participants are we talking here?
Well, as many as we could get would probably be about 6 or 7 a side. I had one famous incident at Armidale. We lived on the railway station, and just past where we lived was a bypass where they used to back trucks in, you know. Once a year, it was a big day for the kids, Worth Circus used to turn up, and they used to park all their cages and things there, and everybody from Armidale had come up to have a look at them, you know. But the big thing for us were the elephants. They used to use the elephants for taking the cages off the railway trucks, and they'd have the elephants strung out along a fence. They'd just stand there, they weren't tied up or anything. And my father used to work through till about 4 in the morning, and then he'd sleep until lunchtime. And he always slept with his feet sticking out the bottom of the blankets. Anyway, a couple of my mates stayed with me the night, and then we went out early and got in the road and got sworn at and so on, you know, watching them unload the things. And then about 11 o'clock we came in to have some morning tea. And it was in a little yard at the back of the place. We were sitting there, and there were 2 big doors over here, or gates. And one of these doors started to slowly open, and an elephant came in, crossed the thing, and the door to my father's bedroom was open, and it put his head in, took my father by the ankle and yanked him out of bed. Anyway, we ended up, Mr. Worth came down and made formal apologies, But the big thing was he gave us free tickets to the circus. And that night when they made the final parade, that elephant came round and stopped in front of us and bowed, you know. I wouldn't have called the king my uncle.
That's a fabulous story. What year roughly was that?
1930.
Yeah.
Well, I was five, so, you know. I remember when during the Depression, this was at Armidale too, the final train for the day was the dinner train. They fed, you know, put them in the dining room to feed them. And apparently it got around amongst the blokes that were jumping the rattlers, you know, the tramps, that if you went up to the railway after the last train had gone, the lady in there would give you the whatever meals and things were left over, you know. And I can still remember these blokes standing outside in the Armidale winter. It would be that sleet falling, you know. And one bloke in particular had an old overcoat, but he had pyjama pants on underneath and sand shoes without laces in them. And they had nothing. They were just broke. They were looking for work, but there was no work around. And then she'd hand out all these old pies and pasties and things that were left over from the trains.
You were 5 years old during the Depression.
Yeah.
Do you remember it being a particularly difficult period?
Not for us, it wasn't. If my father probably had the best possible job you could have in the Depression, and that is he's handling food. We were given accommodation. We were supplied with coal because they used coal in the cooking and ranges, you know. And I don't think I ever sat down to a meal without a menu, because that was what we did for a business, you know. And it was very hard on other people, but not on us anyway. Nobody had any money. And provided you got food and accommodation and the rest of it, you were pretty right.
Teenage years, high school years?
My final school was a boarding school in Sydney. And that was a boys' college, you know. That was because I'd had so many different schools. One school would be a bit more advanced than the next one or so on, and it'd be pretty difficult.
Was that a good experience?
It was in some ways. One of the places we worked at was Byron Bay. Well, for a kid, that was just heaven up there, you know. The swimming and the fishing and it's nothing like it is now. It was just a tiny little fishing village then.
I take it you've been back to Byron Bay a few times?
No, only once, I think. I went back there some years later for fishing, but that was it.
So you're a keen fisherman?
Yeah, I used to be anyway.
What's your favourite meal?
John Dory. I worked on trawlers for a while. You go down to the hold at night and pick your own John Dory, you know.
Where was that?
Off Sydney. We were based in Sydney. Number 5 Circular Quay, I think.
What did you do before the war?
Well, I used to come home from boarding school. The problem then for me was that quite often my parents had shifted, you know, from one place to another, so I didn't know anybody. And I used to do a lot of reading. I never went out very much. Big shock to me was I was a heavy reader of a lot of American writers like Steinbeck, Dos Passos and people like that. And I had an idea of what I thought was American-style things, you know. And I remember standing on the platform at Casino when the first load of American troops came in from off the Queen Elizabeth. And all these GIs got off two or 300 of them on every train. It used to be 5 trains a morning. And every Yank GI had a Donald Duck comic in his hip pocket. And my father wouldn't let me read Donald Duck comics. So I had a different view of America after that, and especially in New Guinea.
When you finished that boarding school, what did you do? What employment did you...
I didn't do any because I went straight into the army. I went down to the barracks for a medical test, still in a school uniform.
So what age were you then?
18. The thing that horrified me when I got down there was a group of blokes sitting on a bench outside discussing how to get out of the army. You got a piece of wood and wrapped it round with forby, you know, for the cleaning rifle, and whacked itself on the knee, and then the knee would swell up. And I was just horrified.
straight into the army.
Yeah, well, I'd had 4 years in the cadet corps, so I knew a bit about it. We were the fair-haired boys for the drill sergeants because I knew more about drill than they did. You know?
Can you talk a little bit about the cadet corps?
All the Sydney schools, GPS schools, had a cadet corps. And we had one on a company of, that would have been 500 or 600 there, I suppose, in it all told. They had a camp once a year, and the officer in charge of the bloke, who was one of the teachers, had been at Gallipoli. And I think he had quite a record. He'd been a sniper, and I think the man, he'd been the furthest up the peninsula of anyone. He ran the show. Once a week, the drill was on a Friday afternoon.
And did he share many stories about his experiences?
Yeah, we used to do it deliberately to get him stopping talking about history, you know. And if you could get him going, he'd keep going all the lesson. But some of the schools were a lot bigger than the one I went to. They had big groups. And then some of them, actually, like King's, for instance, was all run on army lines. We only had it on a Friday afternoon, but they had it 5 days a week. You know. I remember one of the blokes at King's I met later on, I asked him about King's, and he said it was too much marching and praying.
Going through boarding school, it's like, was there a lot of discipline
installed? Oh, yeah. The army, it was a breeze afternoon. The food was better, discipline was easier. You could even go and buy a beer. I enlisted in January, and we left for New Guinea on October.
What year was that, Ted?
It'd be 1943. I turned 19 on the troop ship off Finchhaven. So I was actually 19 when I landed in New Guinea. Legally, you were supposed to be 19 before you left Australia, but a friend of mine, who later on became a judge, he went and saw the CO for me and talked him into letting me go, because by the time I finished training at Kananga, I would have been 19. I wasn't actually, but pretty close.
Within a month?
No, it was about 3 days.
Whereabouts did you do your training? Where was that?
First was Cowra, that was the DP4, the original training. And then the second one was the commando training at Bathurst, and then the commando training at Kananga.
And what was that like? Was that hard?
Yeah, Kananga was. The others weren't so hard, but Kananga was. We were pretty fit, you know. We'd been playing first grade football, and the assault courses and things weren't all that tough at Bathurst, but the ones at Kananga were.
So did you feel, at the end of this period, did you feel you were ready to venture on?
I probably did, but I don't think I was right about it, but I thought I did.
Do you remember how you were feeling? Like,
excited.
Was everyone else in kind of feeling similar? Was it fairly common?
Most of them did. Get the odd one that didn't. But, you know, you got blokes that joined the commando unit because they felt it had some sort of glory about it, and maybe they could skite about it. And then when the reality turned up, it, you know, changed things a bit.
How long did your journey up to New Guinea take?
We moved up to the Tablelands in Queensland to start with, and we were there about a month, I think. The advance party had already gone over, and then we boarded the ship in Cairns. I think it took about a week for the all told from the time we left Queensland.
That was Dora the cat. It took about a week by ship.
Yeah, it'll be about that. I can't remember exactly, but it was a while. And we landed in New Guinea on the 5th of November. And it'll be 43, I suppose. It might be, 43 it'll have to be.
And what were your first impressions when you arrived?
I was a bit surprised, I think. They were in a base camp at the time, and the regiment had been patrolling, but they hadn't been into any action at all, you know. And actually, we covered 1,200 miles before we ran into the first Japs. A fairly slow business.
So what was your responsibilities in New Guinea? What were you there to do?
Well, what happened was on these patrols we did, so no more training patrols than anything else, I realised a lot of these blokes weren't cut out for the scouting bit, you know. And it's not a matter of courage, it's a matter of staying focused. And it's pretty difficult if you've never had any training and that sort of thing. Because a lot of the kids that came in when I went in were kids that had been born and brought up in the Depression. So they'd left school early, so they never experienced having to study or anything, you know. And that sort of taught you the business of staying focused for a long time. And then the bloke that was the forward scout, a fellow by the name of Joe Olson, that had been at Kokoda, this bloke, from 7:30 in the morning till we got back at night, he'd stay focused, you know. And I thought, well, if anybody can get me out of this chamozzle, he can. So I volunteered to be a scout. And I was a scout from then on for the rest of the time I was there.
So what were some of the key aspects of being a scout then?
The main thing was, I said, to stay focused. But Olson, that was the name of the bloke that was a forward scout, used to tell me to stay focused, And one of the things he used to say to me, if you walk round the corner of a track 1,000 times a day, just make certain when you do that you expect to run into something. So you've got your own gun turned on to fire and your finger on the trigger. So if there's anything there, you've got the drop on him. You know? Don't ever go around and not be thinking about it. He was a difficult bloke to get on with, but he's a hell of a good scout. I reckon the best in the business. You know, you might do hundreds of miles before you ran into anything. And then usually when you do, you weren't expecting it. You know.
Are you okay to talk about your first encounter with the Japanese?
Yeah. We were coming back from a patrol, and we were coming down a very steep hill into what would have been a swamp area in the wet conditions, you know. And this stuff, in these areas, you get this saksak, which is it's native-grown tapioca, and they used to cut the palm trees down and split them and get the tapioca out of it. We're just at the bottom of the ridge, and somebody had put an earth bank in to make a dam there, but it was dried up. Olson gone ahead of me. Second scout may need to watch his back. And he'd gone over the ridge, and I was just climbing up to it, and he opened fire. And when I got over the top, what had happened was there was a party of Japanese working in there, and it opened fire on them. And as I got down over the ridge, this nip stepped out of the bush with an axe, and after Olson came after Olson, you know, and Joe had run out of ammunition. So that was my first introduction to the Japs.
Is that very vivid in your mind still?
Yeah, I'd say it is. It was a difficult shot, you know, he was directly in front of me. And the bloke with the axe was only from here to me, from here to you at least. So I'd never shot any before. But
did you feel that your outlook on life changed in some way after an experience like that?
Yeah, it took a while to get over it. It didn't bother me at the time it happened because I didn't have time to think about it. But later on that night, it was a bit difficult to handle.
Part of your training, I'm sure, is about focusing on quick decisions and and it's a matter of your survival ultimately, isn't it? Was there any other events or experiences maybe that stand out in your mind?
The powers that be had decided they wanted this. It was like a MISA, you know, a raised sort of series of hills without tops on and flat, because they wanted to use the biscuit bombers to come in and supply for the troops forward. And they sent us out to clear this and sort of set it up. And an infantry company had gone through the day before, according to them, and it was clear, you know. My section was leading the crowd in. We had, I think, 1,000 machine gunners with us too. They'd taken the guns off them and turned them into pioneers or something. We were walking down towards the creek after lunch, and this Jap jumped up and he had water bottles all over him, you know, and bolted. Well, I went round one side and Olsen went round the other, and I came out onto this track. And the Japs used to wear two-toed boots, and this track's all ploughed up with two-toed boots, you know. And then just ahead of us is Mesa. And I'm walking towards it, and the sniper opened up on me, and I dropped down behind a log. And all those logs in New Guinea are rotten. You can poke your finger through them, you know. And he knew I was there, and he's working down the log about a foot at a time. Every bullet hit the back, and just a little clump and big piece of wood had come out. And it was alive with those little black leeches, you know, they've been that big. And there's one thing I'm scared of, and that's leeches. I'd rather crocodiles. Anyway, I stood it for a while and I waited till the last shot, and then I got up and got the hell out of it. And it took us 5 days to take the place. And another schmozzle was that we'd ordered an airstrike, and there was a heavy fog the next morning. And we couldn't stop them, they'd taken off, you know, and we had fires going, and they thought we were laying smoke. And they bombed us instead of the Jap. But fortunately, it was a fairly steep ridge, so most of the bomb went down the side. But it was pretty hairy.
Was there quite a bit of confusion? And
I say it was, more than quite a bit.
So this is now 1944, we're talking 44. About. And how long were you in New Guinea?
18 months. I would have been 16 months. I had 16 months in New Guinea, then 2 months in Rabaul. That was after the war finished.
What were you doing there?
Oh, nothing. They were just waiting for us to go home. But they had this point system, which depended on when you joined up, whether you were married, how much overseas service you'd seen. And people like me were pretty well down on it, so we had to wait while everybody else went home before we got home. And I think the Australian government didn't want to bring back 1 million blokes into the work market, you know.
So what did you do there?
Nothing, didn't do anything. I was working in Victoria, at Marrickville Barracks, and then at the showground, working with the people that were discharging blokes, you know. But I don't know what my job was. I never really had a job. I was just making up the numbers, you know.
So after 18 months of service then, you were discharged?
Yeah, eventually. Pretty bad time too. I suppose people were so sick of the war, and almost every second day or so, going home on the bus, somebody had chipped me, you know, why don't you get a proper job, and this sort of thing. A bit hard to take.
And that was quite common?
Oh, hell yeah, yeah, very common.
Do you remember your feelings?
Yes, I do. I feel like punching him in the nose, you know. I never did, and somebody else had more sense than I had and advised me not to, because he could probably bring charges against me.
And how long did that attitude remain in Australia?
Oh, for quite a while after the war. It was nowhere near as popular in Anzac Day then as it is now. When I came here, I went to the first Anzac Day service here, and one of the women there came up and thanked me. That's the first time that ever happened, you know. I couldn't believe it.
Oh, really?
Well, the last march I went to, I didn't march, but I was in the back of a Jeep, and people came up and shook my hand and that sort of thing. Mm. Yep. Altogether different. You know?
Just backtracking a little bit, you were telling me the story there about having to dive down behind this rotten log and having someone shoot foot by foot at you, and the leeches coming out of the wood. How does it feel to have someone shooting?
Pretty scary, especially when you can't see it. You know, he was up higher than I was, and he was in the heavy scrub, and I couldn't see any flash from the rifle or anything. But I had Joe Olsen was under a tree about 50 yards from me, ahead of me. I'm back here. And I had a mate who was adaption to the rifle for firing grenades. And he fired a grenade and it hit the branch over Joe, where Joe was, and dropped straight down in front of him.
He was okay?
Yeah, it was okay. And the air turned blue for a while.
So do you feel that your experiences with all the training that you had and all the, even if we go back to boarding school, did that hold you in good stead then after the war?
Yeah, very much so. Mm-hmm. Well, the three of us went in together. Two of us were at school together. The other bloke we knew through the football, he was at another college. It made a hell of a difference in the fact that a lot of the blokes that went in, as I said, were, you know, youngsters during the Depression. They had a lot more trouble than we had because we were used to the discipline that was involved. Well, certainly in the beginning, the first few weeks there, we found it pretty easy because it was certainly a lot easier than school. The discipline was nowhere near as tough as it was at Newington, and the food was a damn sight better, you know. You could always go back and get some more.
What did you do after the war?
Well, first of all, I got a job with ANSET, that, you know, they were crowds. I used to do a night thing there with the, mainly on the cargo. And then the government started a course in fishing, professional fishing, you know, mainly trawlers, that type of thing. So I went to that. But they had the idea that there was a crowd in Sydney called Red Funnel that had bought the original ships from when the Australians had a, when the government had a fishing fleet. They bought those ships, they were steam-driven trawlers. And the idea was that if you went to this school, then you'd come out as a deck officer, you know. But Red Funnel didn't agree to it. And I didn't have the money to be able to buy a trawler, so it sort of didn't go, I couldn't go on with it. But I did the course, and I spent a fair bit of time on the trawlers working, fishing off from Sydney down the coast. They had both the same trawler and the otterboard trawlers too. So I did both of those.
And how many years did you do that?
I was there about 12 months. And then I went into the bush and I started off on a relative wheat and sheep place. And in those days it was all bagged wheat. And I reckon that was enough for 1 year. So I went, got into the pastoral companies and it was mainly cattle and sheep stuff, you know. I enjoyed it, but I just didn't have the money.
Whereabouts was that?
Mainly West New South Wales, but I also came over here and worked with B.H. McLaughlin on some of the places out here near the Western Australian border. Commonwealth Hill was the next door neighbour to us where I worked. That was Mulgething. But B.H. McLaughlin owned both of them.
Did you keep in contact with friends from service?
Only one or two of them. They were from New South Wales. One of them, this bloke I went to school with, we're still in contact with one another.
What age is your friend?
Same as me, 2 months older than I am.
Fantastic. And how do you keep in touch? Do you phone?
Phone mainly. I used to write letters to him, but my writing not so good these days.
How do you feel, Ted, about growing up and witnessing and experiencing the Great Depression and then living through and surviving World War II? Now today we have this thing called COVID-19. How do you feel about, what are your thoughts on COVID-19? Do you have any ideas or feelings about that?
No, not really. I realise how horrific it is. I mean, it's done more damage than a nuclear bomb. And it isn't finished yet, it's still going. I think it was probably inevitable it would happen, but I just hope it wasn't in my time.
Do you have any reoccurring events in your life that keep popping up in your mind?
Not anymore, they don't. For quite a while after the war they did. And I used to dream about things too. That sort of eventually I got over it.
You're 95 years of age now. You're feeling you're in good health?
Reasonable.
Feeling strong? Feeling positive and optimistic?
Not very strong. I'm as weak as a kitten, actually.
Can you tell me a little bit about your time here in Burra?
Well,
14 years.
For the first 10 years, I think I spent working on this place. It's only in the last year or two that I haven't been able to do it. And I'm sort of isolated to the house, you know.
I saw there's a fantastic collection of eggs, painted eggs.
Yeah, those Chinese eggs. Apparently, they're different families in China do them, and they have a sort of copyright of what they're doing. Like one does flowers, somebody else does birds, somebody else does animals, and they belong to the family, you know. We collected them, my wife and I collected them for quite a long time.
How many have you in your collection?
I don't know, I think there's about 100 odd there.
Wow.
All told. I know we bought a hell of a lot from a place in Coonabarabin, I think it was, that had them, but they weren't selling, so he sold them cheaply and he bought them.
You were born in 1925. The year now is 2020. Can you tell me what is the secret to longevity?
I don't know what it is. Obviously, health's got a lot to do with it. I think I have one other relative who's was older than I am when she died. She was 97. But I'm the oldest member of Dis McMillan, and my other side is the Bodnam family. I'd be the oldest ever for them. My grandfather died at the age of about 57 in that Spanish flu thing. My father died at 75, and all the other members of the family have been under 90, you know. My grandmother was 90 when she died, and that was a bit of a record then, but her daughter was 97, and then there's me.
Fantastic.
I don't know how it happens. Just a fluke, I think. My friend that I told you about, went to school together, he says it's because it was the life we led as kids at Newington, you know. It was really, what would you call it, very hard. Very tough. I mean, it was no heating, no hot water, you had to have cold showers. You know, it was really tough. And maybe that hardened me up. I've never had a cold shower since.
Edward George John McMillan, thank you very much for your time and for sharing your stories with us. It's been an absolute privilege. Thank you.
Oh, good. Thanks.
You have been listening to The RSL, A Time to Celebrate, 2020.